Hi everyone, and welcome to Season 2 of the Yonsei Podcast. I'm Michelle from Nikkei Rising, and I'll be one of your hosts for today's episode. As the young adult branch of Japanese American Memorial Pilgrimages, we'll be bringing you roundtable discussions with young adults involved in and around the Japanese American community to honor our community's history and explore its implications today.
Hey y'all, I'm Matt, your other host for today's episode of the Yonsei Podcast. For this episode, our last one of 2020, we'll be talking about Nikkei in Japan. For those of us who were born outside of the unit of Japan and our decisions to return to Japan for school, work, or something else.
Our first guest today is Christy Ishii, 4.5 Gen JA UCLA alumna from California, ex-JET program English teacher in Gunma, ex-agency recruiter in Tokyo, and also started her own business as a career coach. She's the current JACL Japan Chapter President and former JACL Kakahashi participant in 2014. Welcome to the Yonsei, Christy.
Hi, everyone.
Our second guest tonight is Mika Zatera. She's a 3.5 Gen JA from Chicago and went to school at USC, where she was president of the USC Nikkei Student Union and also a former Kakahashi Project participant back in 2017. Welcome to the Yonsei, Mika.
Hello.
So to start, we'd love to hear a little bit more about what brought you to Japan, where you were located, and how long you were there. Maybe Christy, if you'd like to start.
Sure. So I went to Japan on the JET program in 2016, right after graduation. And I moved directly to this really small town called Tatebayashi in Gunma-ken, which is like two prefectures above Tokyo. And I was there for 2 years before moving to Tokyo for another 2 years.
Awesome. Mika, would you like to share a little bit more about your experience?
Sure. So I was going to school at USC, and then they had a study abroad partnership with Jochi Daigaku in Tokyo. So I lived in Tokyo for a semester, so around 4 to 6 months. And yeah.
That's awesome. I think it's great that you both got to have different experiences and got to go for different reasons. And so sort of thinking about those reasons and what you got to do while you're in Japan, I think a few people probably know the answer, but what drew you to go back to Japan for more than just a vacation? What drew you to go back and live, work, study, and sort of uproot your whole life for a few months or a few years back to Japan?
I think it's interesting that you say go back to Japan, because I feel like whenever we talk about Japan, we talk about going back somewhere when we never really came from there. but anyways, what drew me to Japan was actually this kind of lack of Japanese-ness that I felt come out when I went to Los Angeles, because I grew up pretty much in a non-like Asian community in Salinas. So kind of like being the token Asian, I was always like the Japanese girl. And so I went to UCLA and met a bunch of like Japanese nationals, like Shin-Nikkei, people from, you know, households that like spoke Japanese and they had relatives in Japan. And I was questioned a lot, like, oh, are you Japanese? I'm like, yeah. And they're like, oh, so you speak Japanese? And I was like, no. And so that happened a lot in college. And I felt like I was kind of what you'd call, what people call like a banana or something, like a Twinkie. Like, I don't know. Like, I didn't feel very Japanese. And so that was one of the main reasons, that plus reclaiming the language, as to why, like, I wanted to go to Japan.
Yeah, it's cool. Like you mentioned, like being exposed to a different kind of group of people than you're used to, and people that have come kind of from all different places to go to college, kind of expose you to that different, I guess, sort of experience of being Japanese American. And so it's kind of cool that that prompted you to learn more about your heritage.
Okay. Oh, Christy, that's really interesting about your experience, because for me, I was kind of like born and raised with my oba-chan, and she's from Hiroshima and she doesn't speak English, even though she's lived in America like for like 50 years. So I was kind of like, so that's why I said I'm like a 3.5 gen, because like I kind of feel like a sansei, but also like a nisei a little bit, because my grandma kind of was so antiquated, I guess. Like she's so used to like being Japanese, only speaking Japanese, and that's kind of how I grew up. So for me, I wanted to go study abroad there because I thought about genuinely, like, if I wanted to live there longer term in the future, and to also, like, so we have family in Hiroshima as well. So it was nice living near them for a short time in my life. And yeah, I wanted to improve my Japanese more. Like, I'm conversational, but I wanted to be, like, business proficient. And I'm still, unfortunately, I'm not. But it was a good experience in that sense.
Wait, so that's really interesting because you mentioned your bachan speaks Japanese, right? And you spoke to her in Japanese. So I grew up speaking English to all my grandparents. And I only found out after, like, I moved to Japan and started being able to speak really well that only one of, like, my grandparents, like, one of them can speak because they moved back to Japan after World War II for, like, 5 years. Mm-mm. But if she hadn't gone back, I would, like, have no living relatives, like, in the States that can speak.
So,
it's interesting.
That's interesting. Yeah, so my obachan doesn't even speak English. So that's the problem we have. So we all have to speak Japanese. And I think if she spoke English, I don't know if we would have learned Japanese the way we have. Because, like, we've always had to translate for everything. So, like, my mom was born here, but was fluent in both. And so was my uncle. But yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I think language plays an important role in also deciding whether we want to go back, whether we grew up with it or whether we didn't. Because I'm like Christy, I grew up with grandparents who didn't speak any of the languages from the countries that their parents and their grandparents had come from. So for me, it was always wanting to learn more about Japanese or Chinese or Russian or German or Hebrew. And I think going along those same lines, when you got to Japan, also before you got to Japan, I guess, what was your level of proficiency in Japanese? And then when you got to Japan, how was that sort of barrier of having to learn and use Japanese every day? And how's your Japanese gotten better while you were there and since coming back?
So for me, I currently also live with my obachan right now. We're quarantining together. So I speak Japanese at home. So I was, like, intermediate, and I was taking it at USC too. I wanted to become, like, a fluent or, you know, business proficient. So I went to study abroad at, like, Sophia University is what it's called. Speaking Japanese every day wasn't a very big deal for me. I think the problem became when I had to have, like, these real interactions with people you didn't know. Like, if you, like, take somebody's seat, for example, like, some things that you don't normally, like, have to deal with when you speak Japanese at home. Because, like, again, like, the only Japanese I ever used was, like, practically. So, like, oh, food's ready and, like, you know, those kinds of things. Where, like, it gets you far if you're, like, ordering food at a restaurant and stuff. But, like, I don't know how to, like, file for a visa in Japanese. Like, that was hard for me, like, those kinds of things. Like, the really advanced Japanese, I definitely had a hard time with that. But otherwise, it was nice to be able to, like, think and, like, function in Japan for a little bit because of the language ability, I guess.
That's super interesting, Mika. So for me, I started taking Japanese classes at UCLA. They have this, like, intensive course. It's like a 9-week thing, and they try to put in, like, 3 quarters worth of Japanese into 9 weeks, and I died. But
oh my god, good for you.
But it was really fun, and I met, like, my first Japanese friends at, like, in that time period over the summer, and I took, I think, up to level 5, it was, like, in I don't know, university levels or whatever. But then there was this gap between, like, when I moved to Japan and when I actually took that course. And so it was, like, maybe a year or so. And it was, like, learning in a classroom. It wasn't really using it every day. So when I got to Japan, I was so unprepared to function in the countryside.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Of course not. Yeah. Also, the accents are all different in every prefecture and everywhere. I completely understand that. Oh, my God.
Yeah. And, like, I literally felt like I was 5 years old, and almost, like, looking, when I did reflections, like, looking back on that time, I was pretty much like disabled because I couldn't understand, right? Like what people are telling me, couldn't really get out like what I wanted to say. And that like plus just sticking out like a sore thumb because all my clothes were bought in the US. Like I didn't have the Uniqlo wardrobe that like everyone so
also you're in the countryside too, so like the fashion is like so different.
Yeah, like you get it, like I don't know. Yeah, I don't think people like I don't know how many people know what it's like to live in the countryside, but I definitely
my grandma's side in Hiroshima, they're from like the countryside of Hiroshima, so whenever we go to visit, it's like we're like on a rice paddy kind of thing, like it's very rural. I understand what you're talking about fashion, because it's very different there, especially compared to Tokyo. So I get it.
Yeah, totally. And like the language stuff, I mean, basic things like literally just writing my name and my address. I just remember, like, because, you know, like when you get an apartment, right? So on the JET program, they have an apartment there, but you still have to sign everything and do all the stuff at the like gyaksho and like you're saying, like the visa stuff, like, yeah, anything that has to do with like your legally, like your legal documents, like living in Japan and stuff like that, that's kind of.
Did they help you at all? Or like, did you have to do that all by yourself?
Like there was always someone there, like standing watching over me, but like I had to physically like write most of it. Sometimes they would write it like for me, but it was just kind of like, I remember going my first time, I was like talking to the gas guy or something, and he came over to the apartment and there's no air conditioning in the kitchen, right? Because you know how like in the countryside you only have this like one aircon, like, or whatever, like, and so there's some parts of the house that are super hot. And so JET program starts in the summer, so it's the August summer, like countryside. Tatabashi was like one of the hottest places in Japan. Like it's usually top three.
Oh my God.
And I was like kneeling on the ground, writing on this stool, writing in a pen. And if I messed up, I would have had to like get a whole new paper because everything, I don't know, you can't mess up on your name and stuff. So I'm like sweating, like trying to figure out how to write my, like, my dang like address. And I was just, I felt so like dumb and like also ashamed that I couldn't do that. And so the language thing was actually a really big struggle for me in the beginning, like the first half a year, because I put so much pressure on myself to be able to just like pick it up. I don't know what it was, like I thought because I was like Japanese American for some reason that would give me the power to like
learn. No, I get it. I completely get it. Like I had those same feelings as well, like when it came to like the getting the, you know, the national insurance. It was so embarrassing. I had like my host mom come with me and that was nice, but it was also like, you know, you had to handle all these things essentially by yourself, and it's a little bit embarrassing when you're like, yeah, I completely get it when you said about writing your name down. I had the same experience.
Yeah.
Do you think like the language factors or anything, I know you mentioned like fashion, did any of those things kind of make you nervous before you like left for your trip, or did you have like certain expectations of how things would go? Or what were your like initial feelings right before you were leaving?
I was obviously nervous, but I was only living there for like a semester. So if I didn't love it, it wasn't like I was signing up for like a long-term stay. So I always had that in the back of my mind as kind of a comfort. But, you know, I had been to Japan a couple times before that, like once with another USC program and then once with my, or and a handful of times with my obachan. So like I was familiar with it, Japan, like I had been there before, so I wasn't going in completely blind, so that did help.
Yeah, so I guess I also kind of had a few experiences going to Japan. I think it was there was one high school exchange with our sister city that I went on. I didn't speak any Japanese, and that was kind of like a really interesting experience. I just was like, wow, Japan, like really bright-eyed, bushy-tailed. And then like the second time was the Kakehashi, JCL Kakehashi trip. I think that's when I realized like I wanted to live in Japan. Something about that trip made me feel like I could be like a Kakehashi. It was momentous. But then the third time was doing the GPIUS empowerment program. And it's this like 6 week, when I went, it was 6 weeks. I think it's 5 weeks now, but it was like a leadership and English like summer 1 week program. And we went to five different schools. I stayed with five different host families. And it gave me the sense of like, oh, I know Japan, like I can live there. I've met like five families. I don't know. I had this really weird like confidence about moving there. But I also still had this very real like, I don't know if it's like a yonsei gosei thing, but like this idea that Japan is like what we see at our local like obon festivals and stuff, and all the traditional stuff that is kind of like in a time capsule from like pre-World War II, like that our great grandparents like brought over to America. Like that was my image of Japan more or less. And so going there and realizing, I don't know, I had a lot of expectations, I guess, of what I thought Japan was like. And then
did you think it was like too modern when you got there, or
well,
like in terms of like how people live? Because it is like I know what you're saying a little bit, because like my grandma and the way she imagined Japan was from when she was living there like 50 years ago, so it has changed a lot. And especially like Tokyo, it's different than like Hiroshima. And so like I kind of thought that it was a little going to be a little bit more like, you know, in the morning people have more of a traditional breakfast versus actually they just have bread now. Like, is it something like that? Or
yeah, no, I just like in my mind I thought like everyone did like mochitsuki for like the New Year's, or I thought like really basic stuff, you know, like the stuff that I don't know. I went to this cultural like Japanese camp thing every year since I was a kindergartner all the way up until like seventh grade. And then you can like do volunteer stuff after as a high schooler, but it was called Hikari no Gakko. And it's like a 2 week summer camp that we did. And we learned like, I don't know, about Japanese culture. It wasn't like a J school. Like we didn't learn the language. We sang like hoikuen songs and like we watched taiko, kendo, karate, like demonstrations and stuff. So I had this like very textbook image of what Japanese culture was. But then when I went there and like I was hanging out with my friends like in Tokyo, so I'd go back and forth between Gunma and Tokyo, and all my like university friends, it just seemed like all that historical stuff, like, oh, why do we do this? Why do we do that? Like there wasn't really a known answer amongst like the youth. It was just kind of like the culture of Japan, I feel like, was more present and significant in the States. Whereas going to Japan, it's like everyday life and the traditions are kind of part of the past. And so I was like, oh, so like, yes, of course, duh, Japan is modern now. Like, I don't know what I was expecting, but I think the countryside, though, was very different. Like that entry point was super different than if I had gone to Tokyo. So I actually felt like things are pretty old fashioned in Gunma. I mean, like I had a bank book. Do you guys know what a bank book is?
Is that for like for checks or?
Like, no, like to find money? Out, like to keep track of like how much money you have in your bank, you have to pull out your paper bank book and like stick it in the ATM. And then it'll write down your balance and then spit it back out. Like
that's a thing.
Like that's a thing in 2020 in the countryside in Japan. And there are all these things like that. I don't know, it was new to me, but it felt like I had stepped into like maybe like the 70s or the 80s in the US.
I was just going to say, like for me, like my host family, they were like a lot more like modern and like Western than I was expecting. I mean, like I mentioned earlier, I thought that like for breakfast, you know, you're supposed to have like miso shiru and like gohan and that kind of stuff, which is like what is traditional, I guess. But then they would have just like shokupan,
yeah,
and just like toast. And I was like, what? Like, I was like genuinely surprised because, like, oh my God, like this, but that's like normal. And because, like, you know, having that full on breakfast is like unrealistic nowadays. But, and then like other things, like they had a regular bed and they didn't like sleep on like futons on the floor or anything. Yeah. And like other things, just like little things that are like, oh, it makes sense because, first of all, I am in Tokyo. It is a modern city and people are going to progress, right, over the years. Yeah, I don't know what I thought.
Yeah. And I think it's just really interesting, though, how depending on like who we live with for like a homestay or just who we see, it really impacts like our image of like Japan as a whole. Because I remember in Gunma, to be honest, it wasn't the greatest experience. Like, I don't know if you talk to other Jets who go to like rural Japan and they're like Japanese American, sometimes it's really not exciting and not the best. It's not the most positive experience, and that's how it was for me in the beginning. And I went in with this super strong like obsession with Japan. Like, I loved Japan. Like, every time I had gone before was the best trip I had ever been on. And so when I went there for the JET program, it was not that. And part of that, I think, was I didn't have this kind of veil of like, I'm on an American program, so like everyone knows I'm American. You get a certain privilege, right, when you go to Japan and you're I don't know, and people know you're American. But in my case, like, I stepped into the countryside without, you know, waving a flag above my head that's like an American flag. Like, nobody knew. And I think I realized that like there is a huge privilege and like a huge difference between like just visiting as a foreigner and like living there.
You've answered a lot of our questions already.
Yes.
which has been great, and you've touched on a lot of things that we've actually, I think, talked about in previous episodes. Like, Matt, do you remember if we talked about like the Japanese culture versus Japanese American culture and having more sometimes traditional events and whatnot or customs here versus in Japan, or we have just kind of a different sense of what being Japanese means? I feel like that's come up in other episodes.
Yeah, it's definitely come up before. And I know we're actually planning on doing a whole episode about that sometime in the future. But yeah, I think especially for Michelle and I, because we went on Kakahashi together, and that's also where I met Christy, of course. I think all of our experiences were very, very different, and what expectations and what we thought about Japan was very different going in. And of course, what we got out of it was extremely different because we're on this government-sponsored program, and we get to do things that a lot of people wouldn't normally get to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we are sort of at times playing tourists. Like, we got to do museum trips, and we got to see castles and gardens and all these wonderful, amazing things. Like I'm sure Mika and Christy both did when they were on Kakahashi. But at the same time, like, we met with government officials, we met with students to talk about Japanese American culture and history, and what it's like being all of us being Japanese, but in different ways. Because, and we've been sort of learning about what it means to be Nikkei and the different ways that people identify as Nikkei, where for us in the US, we call ourselves Nikkei, and other parts of the world, they call themselves Nikkei Jin. And then even in Japan, what Nikkei and Nikkei Jin mean to them. So I think it's really fascinating seeing how all of us have had similar experiences, either through Kakahashi or through other programs, and how different the outcomes are and how different we both go into it and how we come out of it as well.
Sorry, because Matt was talking about like how people identify, right, and what identity terms like in America versus Japan mean. I was just really curious to know, Mika, if you like how you identified, or if people ever asked you
that question. Nobody's really asked me that, but that's like really nice to ask. Thank you. I guess I'd say I'm Japanese American, but like, I don't know if that term like really like resonates with me as much, because I feel like, you know, our culture is like, again, with my obajan, like, she's very Japanese. Like, she's from the countryside of Hiroshima. Like, she's very, like, she grew up just like on a farm, you know, so she's traditional and all of her family is traditional. And whenever like we go to visit them, it's like old fashioned, you know, like I have like that full Japanese breakfast every morning and I sleep on the floor in the tatami room, you know. So I kind of feel like I'm Japanese in America, so like I'm Japanese American, but I don't feel like, you know, like necessarily like the Nikkei culture 100% aligns with me. Because also in Chicago, it's not as big of a Japanese community anymore. I know like with my mom's generation, it was. And she grew up around that. So like she grew up like doing like the traditional Japanese dancing and all that stuff. Like at the Buddhist temples and all that kind of stuff. And then with me, it kind of like that group of Japanese people like kind of moved away or like went back to Japan. So I just don't know if Japanese like American per se like fits me 100%.
Yeah, no, I was just curious because for me, like I did a lot of stuff in the community, like in Little Tokyo and whatnot. And what happened with my, like, I don't know, identity terms, it went from like being Japanese to being Japanese American. And then I went to Japan and tried to explain like my background, and that did not work. Like that didn't translate. Right? There's no context. I tried to use like Asian American, and then I was like, oh, what? No, they wouldn't know what that means. And so that was really a big struggle point for me because I was like, it's the language, but it's also like, I don't even know what term would resonate because when you go to the countryside, it doesn't make sense. Like I guess it's a podcast, you can't tell, but like I'm like Japanese American on both sides. So I'm like Yonsei on my dad's side, Gosei on my dad's side, Yonsei on my mom's side. And so I can pass like in Japan as a Japanese person, but that doesn't register. Like a English speaking Japanese person who doesn't speak Japanese in Japan was seen as somebody who like was slow. Like I was told so many times, like I don't know if I can say this on like, oh my baka da yo toka. Like they would just tell me like, you know,
stupid,
like how, like this happened a couple times and it was always an older like Japanese dude. I don't know if that's
it's
trend.
It's a man, right? It's never a woman, right?
Yeah. So
okay.
Yeah. Right. But it like that kind of stuff happened, and so I was just curious because I got asked a lot, like, what almost like what's wrong with you type of question because those first 2 years were solely like in the countryside, and so that was the first time I felt like I got exhausted like explaining myself.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so I don't know. I was just kind of curious. But no, Tokyo. Yeah.
But also, I'm half Japanese. So on my mom's side, Japanese, my dad's Italian. So whenever I'm in Japan, I always have to like overcompensate because they don't expect me to be speaking Japanese at all. Like they will speak horrible English to me before they will speak Japanese to me. So I always had that problem because I'm like, I'm not Japanese looking. Like, I mean, I look half, I think, if you know that, but if you're not like open to that, you probably just think I'm a foreigner, which is what I look like, I guess. So like in Tokyo, like everybody would try to speak to me in English and I'd be like, no, you can speak to me in Japanese. It would actually be easier for me if you spoke to me in Japanese. But so then they're always like genuinely surprised. Like I did some kind of hat trick or something when I speak Japanese and they're like, oh my God. So then I always have to, like, I always kind of lie and say, like, okay, my mom's Japanese, like, she's from there almost, because otherwise they don't get it. So then I'm like, yeah, my mom's Japanese and my dad's Italian. And then I'm, like, a spectacle. Like, they're like, oh, my God, oh, that's so cool, you know? So, like, I almost have, like, the opposite problem from you because they don't have any expectations for me when I'm there.
Yeah. Yeah, it is literally, yes, I get it.
And especially in the countryside. But then like, so like when I go to Hiroshima, for example, like I speak the Hiroshima dialect because that's what my grandma does. Like then it kind of like works because they're all of a sudden like, oh, you get it. Like you understand like this accent or whatever, this dialect. And then all of a sudden I feel like I'm welcomed into like even like like somebody I've never met before. Like I had like a weird interaction with somebody at a supermarket before. Anyway, that like works. Because I guess it's like the dialect, and also people in Hiroshima are like very, very proud to be from there. If they just look at me, they're like, oh my God, I want to take a picture with this white looking woman in the middle of nowhere, you know?
Yeah.
That was just my experience.
Yeah. And I think that's another part of it is identity and how we identify with our Japanese heritage, or whether we identify as Japanese American or Nikkei gene for some folks. And I think that's also why we're so drawn to this part of our life. Cause I mean, like for me, cause she's half for Michelle also and myself, we're all mixed. So I think it's a part of ourselves that we grew up with and that we, for whatever reason, strongly identify with, and why we identify with it so strongly is, I think it's just something that pervades the community. Like, we're just so proud of being Japanese American, regardless of whether we're full Japanese and we're fifth gen or we're mixed and we're first gen. It's just something that I think we've always been proud of. And I think that's always sort of also what brings us back to Japan. But I know y'all touched on a little bit, sort of these challenges and things you didn't know, things that surprised you, but were there any other sort of stories of things that you weren't expecting that you really had to figure out and overcome in your time there that you think people should know about?
Yeah, I mean, I guess like being half Japanese, and especially if you're a female, I think you're kind of like sexualized a little bit. I mean, that was like some of my experiences, especially like my other half friends. I also met a couple of other half friends while I studied around there too. And we always had like that issue whenever we were together. Like, catcalling isn't really a thing there, but like sometimes it would happen to us. And it was just like really weird. And like, you know, you would be on the train and they would just like stare at you because you look foreign, at least. Mm. I think that's the thing. So that was a little bit hard for me. And then also like I felt the pains of like being a woman in kind of like a male centric society. You know, I didn't have that before, and I didn't really notice it before when I would be on trips with my family, because you just don't see it when you're surrounded by like either one other Japanese people or two like males.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's so funny. Like, I feel like I could just have a forever conversation with Mika, but like basically.
Yeah, Christy, we'll start our own podcast. Don't worry.
Everything like she just said, I totally understand, but it's for the completely opposite reason. Like, so you would think like someone like me wouldn't get stared at, but when I'm speaking English with like a friend of mine, then it's all of a sudden like, why are you speaking English? And it's like, I can't say I hate it, but it was really hard to be stared at like all the time. Mm-hmm. And so it made me conform, I guess. I don't know if it makes other people, but it made me kind of tone down or just be really aware of like when I was using English because of the way that people perceive me. And I was like eating ramen in like Niigata or something with my friend. We were just in the boonies. We were on like a snow trip. And I was like trying to like use my Japanese and like talking about like how we're from California or whatever. And I was talking about, she said something about my English, and I was like, yeah, is it okay to like, you know, do you want to practice English? She's like, oh no, I wanted to tell you that like when we see, I think I was asking her like, why is it weird when people see me speaking English? And she was like, oh, cause it looks like you're showing off, like you're a Japanese person trying to like be like, I don't know. Like, do you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, no, that makes so much sense. That's so weird. I mean, that's also like effed up, you know, like.
Well, but I didn't know, but it's like, I didn't know that was like a perception of potentially what I was doing. Or like when people are in the train, right? Mika, like in there, like holding a book, like if you're reading even like an English book, I thought if I was reading an English book, maybe people would like talk to me. But gyakuni, it's like, that's not good in some senses either. Like some people see that as like, they can read. These are just small stereotypes. But like, I don't know, just stuff that like I was very like aware of when towards the end of my stay in Japan. But in the beginning, I literally like, I did so many, like, what is it called? Faux pas. Like, I was going to Tokyo one time, and I was really needing to talk to people. Like, it didn't matter what language. I was just so, like, I was, like, going from LA to, like, Gunma. And it was, that was just not a good culture change or whatever. So there's a 2-hour train ride to Tokyo, and I had a piece of, like, gum or something. And I just wanted to, like, start a conversation with the person next to me. So I'm in a train in Japan. Like, you don't talk on the train. You don't talk. And I turn to the person next to me. It's this dude. And I'm like, do you want a piece of gum?
Oh, my God.
They freaked out. They were just like, oh, like kind of like, you know, like kind of like jolted back and I was like, oh, sorry. Like, I just, those kind of things, you know, you just, you don't realize how awkward it is and how different, like, culturally. You shouldn't do that.
You know, Christy, like what you're saying about like conforming. I mean, again, like I was only there a semester. So you were there way, way, way longer than I was. But I was feeling like even a couple months in, I started buying more similar clothes to what people were like culottes and all that stuff. Right. Or like, especially in the middle of summer, I was like there in July, which is like the hottest, most humid part time in Japan. And I was like wearing long sleeves and long pants because that's what all the other girls were doing. And then if I did that, I did get stared at less. I mean, I still got, you know what I mean? But I started to conform, like, you know, physically to them. And then it started, I mean, I was so uncomfortable because I was like sweating like so much, but I mean, it worked.
Yeah. No, like clothes though. Like, so you're talking about like being a lady, right? In Japan in a male dominated society. I guess we're really lucky because we hadn't, at the time, I hadn't entered like corporate America yet or anything. So I never felt any type of ceilings or whatever or differences between like girls and guys. But I joined a baseball team in Gunma, and we're on the topic of clothes. I wore Nike shorts one day to their team practice.
Oh, no.
You know the Nike running shorts?
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Oh, no.
Yeah. So, like, they're just, you know, like mid-thigh. Well, depends. I'm short, so they're like mid-thigh on me. So they're not like super short. But in Japan, if you know this, but like people usually wear like leggings underneath their shorts.
Exactly. I was just going to mention that. Did they mention that you were, if you forgot your leggings or something like that?
So they're dudes, right? So they were saying stuff like itchi da ne toka. Like they would say stuff that was like you're being so risque, or like you're like, what are you doing? I can see your underwear. They could see like the white, like the, you know, like the white mesh underneath.
Oh my god, god forbid they see something that, oh my god.
So it was like horrifying because I had been practicing with these dudes. I had my like baseball pants or whatever and socks usually, but it was like summer and it was really hot. And I was like, you know what? It's hot today. I'm just going to wear my shorts. And I couldn't have been more wrong. Like, I knew. Like,
so rough.
I knew, like, I probably maybe, I don't know. I just wanted to wear shorts. I didn't think there would be that much of a, like, backlash. But no. The whole 2 hours was just, like,
oh my God.
It was a lot of heckling. And I tried to ignore it. And, like, I was talking to, there's one guy on the team that I was like really close to, and I was like, why is it such a big deal? And he's like, well, you are the only girl on the team. I was like, okay. Like, okay. Yes, that's probably not the best choice of clothes, but it's just like, it just, I don't know. There were good and bad things about like being on a men's baseball team. Like it was cool to be like the only girl like on the team, and like,
that's cool.
This is off the end of it, but whenever I went up to bat, they would, I played softball for like 9 years, so baseball wasn't like a huge transition for me, but they were freaked out when they saw like a girl, like a tiny girl in the batter's box. And every time I looked over at the pitcher before his windup, he just like froze. You are so, oh my gosh, you like, they had no, they didn't know how to react. I thought it was hilarious. But yeah, clothes are a big thing, like for ladies especially, and it's so, I don't know.
And then like the other thing was like the makeup and the hair. That's the one thing I couldn't conform to, because like I don't do makeup, like I'm not good at it, I'm not gonna pretend to, and also like I don't have time to like do my hair or whatever. Everybody in Tokyo, like they dress to the nines, like they're gorgeous all the time. It's like 6 a.m
and heels. Like,
oh my god, yeah, heels. I was wearing Converse all the time. No.
But yeah, I think for me, though, like going into Japan and the countryside, like I wasn't supposed to wear makeup as a teacher. And then anytime I did something different to my hair, like there was a comment. It was like, ah, kami kawatta ne. And I was like, yes, it changed. Sorede? Like, so what? Like there wasn't really a compliment. It was just more like, oh,
there has been changes that occurred without my knowledge. Yeah. Like,
yeah. I don't know if you ever got that, but it was that, I remember that a lot. Appearance is so big. Like,
and I think it's different because my hair is like naturally like brown. So then people are like, oh, did you dye it? Or like, you know, like it's, they like that, right? Versus like, And then my hair has like a slight wave. It's not pinned straight. So then that's another conversation topic, even though it's like absolutely nothing special, right?
I can only imagine kind of the experiences that you're talking about, because I've only been to Japan, well, twice. Once, and for the longest time, was on the Kakahashi trip, which is, you know, very, very short. And the first time I went, I think I was like 5 years old, and so I don't really remember much. And my knowledge of the language has come and gone in terms that I tried to learn it in high school. And then after that, it just kind of vanished, unfortunately. But I just think it's crazy to hear all of this. And I was actually curious, you know, we've been talking a lot about kind of the challenges that you had faced during your time there, but would love to hear kind of the highlights of your trips and what were your favorite memories or most memorable times there.
I don't know, Mika, you wanna? I'm trying to think.
Sure.
A lot, but yeah.
So ahead. Like, because I studied abroad, like it wasn't like I had to go to a 9-to-5 job. Like I didn't have as much commitments. Like I had class and everything, but I didn't have to, you know, like dress up to go to work every day and have this like routine. So I had a lot of free time. So I did a lot of traveling and a lot of like exploring Tokyo. So like I did, it was funny because like my host parents or family or whatever, they, you know, obviously live, born and raised in Tokyo. And like I had been doing so much stuff in my short amount of time that they hadn't even done that stuff, if that makes sense. Like I went here and like Thursday I do this and then this. Like I was living this life that I don't live outside of study abroad. And I think everybody who study abroad says the same thing, because they know they have this short amount of period in this one place, so they try to maximize it as much as they can. I mean, so like obviously like I was like on food adventures, and I got to travel here and there, and I went to see my family in Hiroshima twice, I think, while I was there. And it was like so cool that I was just able to like hop on a train and like go stay with them for a weekend or a week, you know, because like we've never been that proximity, you know, that close in my lifetime. So that was cool. Friends, like I made a lot of like expat international Japanese friends, which was kind of cool. And I had also made a lot of friends at USC who were Japanese. So then when I was studying abroad there, like our like schedules aligned up. So then I was able to like meet up with them in their hometown, which is kind of cool. So it was like mostly like traveling, like, and that kind of thing that was like really fun for me. Mm-hmm.
That sounds awesome. I always wanted to like study abroad, but because that was another reason I think I wanted to go to Japan, because like I never took that chance. So if anyone who wants to study abroad in the next,
do it.
Yeah, please do.
Always do it. I mean, I know right now is probably not the best time to be doing it, but yeah, outside of right now.
Yeah, no, it's just it's so life changing. I think to, like you're saying, like having that chance to explore a place without having that 9-to-5, I guess.
And the commitments, like, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And I do wish I had extended it and I had done the full year. Because I had all these challenges. Like I was getting disgruntled by like, you know, like the gender issues and like the race issues. But then also like at the end of it all, even though I had all these issues, like I was like, oh, I really wish I had spent more time. I wish I was there longer.
Yeah, no, I totally resonate with that. For me, So 4 years is kind of a lot for me to come through. To put in a context, I went to Japan when I was 22 and I came back when I was 26. And so a lot of like the post-grad feels and like learning the language and then like, I don't know, culture shock, all these things, like first job out of college were like happening at the same time. And one of the things that really made a difference in at least my reasoning like for being in Japan was meeting a family member of mine that was like living in Japan. So my ba-chan, like she went back to Kagoshima for 4 or 5 years in her like middle school, like elementary school days. After getting out of the camps, like they went back to Japan for some time. And her cousin, who's like kind of younger, so she's like 15 years younger. There was like they had a big family. So Hoshie was this little like tiny Japanese like obachan who like I had never met before. But my grandma just she told me like this is her number. this is where she lives. She'll pick you up at this station. I was like, okay. So I went from Gunmaken all the way down to Kagoshima, which is in Kyushu, which is like really far. I went with my friend, my college friend, Tiffany, because she booked a trip to Japan, and this was my first winter, like, not seeing family. Like, I stayed in Japan that first year, which could or could have not been a mistake, but I guess this trip, though, was so formative for me. So I went down to Kyushu, met this lady, and she's just, like, so cute. She just, like, just super welcoming. She's like, Christy-san. I'm like, yes, that's me. I don't know how she knew, but there also weren't that many people out there. And so I had somewhat, what was it, August to December, I had learned like a decent amount of Japanese, but then she was also speaking like Kagoshima-ben, so it was a little hard to understand. But she showed me, she was pointing out as she was driving, like all the relatives, like the dentist or the, I don't know, this shop, that shop. And then she showed me Bachan's like school that she went to. Aww. At the time it had like, I don't know, like 500 students or 1,000 students or something, and now they're only 30. And she showed me like the station, which now is like not in use, but they used to use it a lot. Like the populations are like really shrinking, right? Like it's not, I know people talk about it a lot, but it's like definitely, I could see that a lot. But it was really cool to see the place that like my family, at least one part of my family came from. And then she showed me the family koseki, which is like the, what is it? Like the family, yeah. Like the thing, like the
temple legal grave. Yeah.
Yeah. And on it, like, was my grandma's name. And, like, she showed me the immigration papers. So it went from, like, Kagoshima to, like, Sacramento. And I don't know, like, seeing that and, like, hearing the family history, it changed something in me. Like, my self-confidence. I don't know what it was. Just, like, validation, I guess, that I had family that was from Japan. That had a huge impact on me. And I was, like, really, I don't know if it was happy. I was happy, but I was like, I just felt like really complete after that trip. And then it was like, why am I in Japan? Like, what am I going to do here now? Because I think I was going to fill some type of void. And that was the moment where I was like, I don't need to prove to anyone anymore that I'm Japanese. Like, this is like my personal validation. So that was a really kind of unique thing that I will never forget. And I'm just like, yeah, I'm lucky I got to meet family and that they were still around. So
that's so nice. Wow.
Yeah, that's really amazing. And that's something I've always wanted to do too, is try to go, I mean, much, much further removed, but you go back and try to find my family in Japan too. But as we are coming up on time, I want to thank you all for your amazing stories, your amazing experiences, all the wonderful advice and tidbits and stories that you shared about your time in Japan. And before we end off, I did want to ask you both the last question. So would you go back and live in Japan again? And would you recommend the experience to other people?
I would definitely recommend my experience or doing it, just because it really does push you outside of your comfort zone. And it kind of made me like more of a travel person, or like wanting to try risks. I don't know if I would live in Japan again. I mean, I don't know if I would like the work culture in Japan, first and foremost, especially like corporate culture, because American corporate culture is a lot and Japanese corporate culture is like 10 times worse. So I don't know if I would like work at like a normal company, but like maybe if like a right opportunity arrives, or, you know, even like if I were to retire, I'd love to retire there. Yeah, maybe in the future. Never know.
I recommend the JET program for sure. I think that was a super good experience to like just see Japan outside of Tokyo, because I don't think a lot of people get that side of Japan. I plan to actually go back like temporarily throughout the years moving forward. So part of me feels like I can't not ever visit in a year. Like I feel like I left part of myself there. Like there are a lot of friends in Tokyo and throughout Japan, a lot of distant like family, sort of like host families and family friends and thing and folks like that. So I don't see myself moving back permanently. I just came back to the States in June of this year, but I would also leave this kind of note, though, for folks who are like interested in living in Japan, you can live a pretty decent, like free, like how do I say this? Pretty free lifestyle if you're working for a gaishike or like a foreign company that's like within tech or has a certain company culture, because there is this really strong stereotype that, especially with like Japanese companies, that, you know, you're working like, I don't know, like 12-hour days and stuff like that, which is true for a lot of companies. But the folks that I was friends with, so the bilingual like Japanese nationals, but also bilingual, like, for, like, I don't know, international folks working there, a lot of people actually had really wonderful lives. And if you're an expat in Japan, your living wage in Tokyo especially is so much cheaper than other places, like in the States, like other cities. So it's a great place if you're just, you know, you're single or you got like a partner and you just want to go out, have drinks with friends, come back on the train, not break the bank. It's like a really good place to live and enjoy, but it is far, so recommend it to people for sure.
Well, thank you again, Christy and Mika, for joining us today. It was such a great opportunity to hear from the both of you and hear all of your amazing stories, as Matt said.
Yeah, thank you both so much again. But for everyone listening, be sure to join us for our next episode coming this January, where we'll be discussing Oshogatsu and all of our family traditions. And don't forget to follow at Nikkei Rising on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for release dates, episode titles, descriptions, and guests for the Yonsei podcast, as well as other updates on other Nikkei Rising programs.
And to listen to all of Season 1 and the rest of Season 2, you can find the Yonsei podcast on Spotify, iTunes, and the Japanese American Memorial Pilgrimages website, jampilgrimages.com.
The Yonsei podcast is made by Hiro Adeza, Michelle Heckert, Yoko Fedorenko, Johnny Narita, and Matthew Wisely, with theme music by Michelle Heckert. This episode will be edited by Hiro Adeza, and now sponsored by the Minidoka Pilgrimage Planning Committee.
This has been the Yonsei Podcast, and it's been Yonsei.